We will discuss the mother of all bombs being dropped in Afghanistan yesterday and a threatened U.S. preemptive strike against North Korea if it looks as though North Korea is about to test another nuclear missile. So how do you like all this muscle flexing? I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review. We will talk about these stories and other major foreign policy issues facing the nation, as well as other top national and state stories in the news. And we will welcome your input, your thoughts on what's happening. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. As always, we have with us two guests from different perspectives to discuss and debate the top stories in the news this week. Let me welcome them in. Kevin Hermaning is the chairman of the Republican Party of Marathon County and a financial planner from Wausau. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. And Spencer, welcome to the opportunity to join you today.
Yeah, and Spencer Black is with us, former Democratic State Representative from Madison and Vice President of the National Sierra Club and Adjunct Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at UW-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Kevin.
All right, well, I think we can start with a lot of this military news. Yesterday, the Pentagon says the military dropped its biggest conventional bomb on a cave complex in Afghanistan, which is believed to be used by ISIS. President Trump was asked if the so-called mother of all bombs sent a message to North Korea, and this is what he said.
This sends a message. It doesn't make any difference if it does or not. North Korea is a problem. The problem will be taken care of. I will say this. I think China has really been working very hard. I have really gotten to like and respect, as you know, President Xi.
Well, I'll start with you, Spencer. What do you make of the mother of all bombs being dropped in Afghanistan?
You know, this is a continuation of a policy that's a war that's been going on for 15 years. It's a high-profile armament, but I don't think it's a real change in policy except for the fact that this particular bomb got a lot of attention on cable news. What's really going on with Korea is that, as President Trump said, he said after 10 minutes of talking to the president of China, he all of a sudden realized it's not an easy problem. Kind of brings to mind what he said on health care when he realized it was very complicated. Much of what he's doing would work well on reality TV, but it does not work in foreign policy. North Korea is an intractable problem, and it doesn't give itself easily over to tweets or simplistic statements. So I think Trump, as on so many of these things, is radically changing his view. 1 week ago, China was an enemy. Now China is his best friend. A week ago, Putin was his good buddy. Now he doesn't like Putin. There's a lack of consistency.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to talk about some of those other issues in a little bit more detail. But Kevin, first, what do you make of a big bomb being dropped on caves believed to be used by ISIS?
Well, you know, going all the way back to 2002 and 2003, and many other times during the first part of the war on terror after 9/11, the U.S. dropped a lot of bombs over in Afghanistan. This one, I think, was like 11 or 12 tons. We got up to 8 or 9 tons in the past. This bomb was originally built, by the way, and its fellow bombs, if you will. The manufacturing of these bombs were originally done to prospectively be used to bust the bunkers over in Iran during the nuclear buildup, that the nuclear testing opportunities that Iran was trying to pursue. And, of course, that never happened under either the Bush nor Obama administrations. I think that it's relatively safe, if you will, for this president, President Trump, to go after ISIS in Afghanistan and wherever else they happen to be throughout the Middle East and Africa, various African nations. But I don't think it's really a game changer. Whether or not it really does send a message to North Korea or not, we'll see about that. But you know, this is just the start, I think. Spencer talked about how the president has changed his tune on a couple of things, and he's now the friend of or enemy of certain people. This happens to all presidents, number one. And number two, the circumstances as the problems evolve are going to cause somebody maybe not to become your friend, but you know, when this president talks about respecting people, whether in the past it was Putin during the campaign or, and in the early days of the administration, or now with China, I think respect doesn't mean a love affair. I think it simply means maybe a good negotiator or standing up strong in the face of adversity. It could mean a whole host of things.
NBC News is reporting that the U.S. is ready to launch a preemptive strike with conventional weapons against North Korea should officials become convinced that North Korea is about to follow through with another nuclear weapons test. Tomorrow is a major holiday in North Korea, the anniversary of the birth of the country's founder, and it's thought that dictator Kim Jong-un may celebrate by testing another nuke. Satellite images show that a site is being made ready in a similar fashion before previous tests. But now the U.S. is saying that it's apparently ready to launch a preemptive strike. What do you make of that, Kevin, first?
Well, you know, the dictator in North Korea, the son of the former dictator in North Korea, has been pretty erratic for a long time. A couple of years ago, he killed his uncle, his brother. 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago or so, I believe is either in Malaysia or Indonesia, his agents launched an attack against some of the folks who were potentially opposed to his regime, but one of his relatives. And so I think the big concern of this administration and Secretary of Defense James Mattis is that the North Korean dictator maybe doesn't really have control over his nukes, and maybe it could launch over into South Korea or into Japan, and that would create a whole host of other issues. And the preemptive nature of it, you know, there have been a number of people lately on television and in the newspaper, in the Washington Post in particular, from these troubled nations who said that if it's not the U.S. who's going to keep the bullies in their own backyard, who's it going to be?
What are you thinking, Spencer?
The reason why Donald Trump came to the conclusion that Korea isn't easy is because North Korea, while I certainly agree with Kevin that the current dictator there is totally erratic, they also have the ability. They have the fourth largest army in the world, and they have the ability to cause intense damage to South Korea. More than half the population, as well as the capital of South Korea, Seoul, is within striking distance of a massive artillery of North Korea. South Korea is the 11th biggest economy in the world, and the reason why presidents before, Republican and Democrat, have found North Korea a very big problem is because they're concerned about South Korea, as is South Korea. If you read the reports out of South Korea, they're very concerned that Trump may take a precipitous action that could lead to obliteration of a good part of their country. I mean, if we got in a war with North Korea, I suspect if China stayed out, which isn't a certainty, we could win because we have a very powerful military, but the damage probably to not only to our armed forces, but especially to South Korea would be horrendous. So there's a reason why other presidents have been cautious in approaching North Korea. And I would hope that this president would be as well. I should say that NBC did report that. Other news sources are saying the Pentagon is denying it. And I suspect that for all the bravado of Trump, in the end, we're not going to see any attack on North Korea.
Vice President Mike Pence is going to be in Seoul on Sunday, in what aides say is a show of commitment to South Korea. Because we have so many other stories, let's move on to Secretary of State Rex Tillerson having a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin this week in Moscow. First, that wasn't going to happen, then it did. It reportedly didn't go very well, but was better than expected. President Trump offered a grim description of where he thinks things stand right now with Russia.
Right now, we're not getting along with Russia at all. We may be at an all-time low in terms of relationship with Russia. This is built for a long period of time. But we're going to see what happens. Putin is the leader of Russia. Russia's a strong country. We're a very, very strong country. We're going to see how that all works out.
So, Spencer, how do you think that's all going to work out?
Well, we don't know. Donald Trump has been playing footsie with Putin for a long time, praising him. All of a sudden, he's realizing this fella Putin is a murderous dictator. And as others in his party, like John McCain and others, have said, Putin is not our friend. Trump was wrong to embrace him during the campaign and during his presidency. And I think he's realizing that Putin is a hostile force in the world. If he's changing to take a harder line, I think that would be a positive thing. But it's a complete reversal from where he's been. And I think that Russia has felt enabled in places like Syria, Ukraine, elsewhere, to take an aggressive line with the United States, because Donald Trump has been, at least until very recently, downplaying the danger that Putin poses, not only to the United States, but the world in general.
Kevin?
One of my big concerns is what comes next. Quite frankly, while I agree largely with what Spencer said about, in fact, completely agree that Putin is a dangerous and murderous thug, we've known for roughly 70 years or more, that's a long time, that Russia has coveted a warm water port. And so whether it's through Ukraine or Syria, their opportunities to go into parts of the world where they can become more expansive and spread their type of dictatorships into other parts of the world, most recently back again in the Western Hemisphere, and now that Cuba supposedly is changing, down in Nicaragua, that we have to wonder if we provide too much of a challenge against Russia, perhaps in even taking out Assad, which we're probably going to talk about in a few minutes, in Syria, what comes next? We've had a lot of the Mideast dictators who have been, quote-unquote, our nation's dictators, keeping a lot of the powder keg in check. And if we were to take out Assad, what does Russia do, and is the U.S. prepared to respond appropriately and in the necessary way? I'm not so sure that the U.S., or the American people, have the stomach for that. And I'm not even, while the president has put in place a foreign policy team and a defense team that may be itching for a little bit of a fight, I don't think there's much appetite for it, quite frankly, right now.
We have many issues, including Syria and NATO and other national and state issues to discuss during this edition of The Week in Review. But we'll take our break and welcome callers as well at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Spencer Black and Kevin Hermaning, here on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top political stories this week. We're welcoming your input. What happened this week that matters most to you? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. This just in, as they say, with a little bit of breaking news to share, and we'll get our guests, I guess, to react. Janesville fugitive Joseph Jakubowski has been captured in Vernon County. The Rock County Sheriff's Department says he was found camping on a farm in Reedstown this morning. Law enforcement took him into custody without incident. Jakubowski is suspected of robbing a gun store in southern Wisconsin and sending an anti-government manifesto to the White House. Dozens of police and federal officials have been searching for him since the gun store was robbed in Janesville last Tuesday. Law enforcement will hold a press conference and release more information later this afternoon. I guess, I don't know, a reaction, Kevin, to the capture of this guy?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I mean, I don't have a lot to add but or say about it. I think it's good news, but I think there are a lot of people who have for decades been sending anti-government manifestos to the White House and other elected officials. I noted that the governor canceled their Easter egg hunt because of the fears about this. I wonder if there might be some quick rescheduling.
Oh, I suppose they still have time, but... Spencer, a reaction to this?
Well, I don't think I have much to add. Glad to see that something that was considered a potential danger to the public is taken care of.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, Spencer, you started with this, that President Trump has backtracked on a number of different big issues this week, or, you know, reversed his position that he had taken earlier or during the campaign, including the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Earlier, he had said that NATO wasn't pulling its weight with regard to terrorism. He called NATO obsolete. And here's what he said on Wednesday after meeting with NATO's Secretary General.
The Secretary General and I had a productive discussion about what more NATO can do in the fight against terrorism. I complained about that a long time ago, and they made a change. And now they do fight terrorism. I said it was obsolete. It's no longer obsolete.
So what do you think of that, Spencer?
NATO hasn't changed a bit. Trump has changed. You know, this flip-flop on NATO is one of about a dozen in just the last week where it hasn't just modified the position, but Trump has done a 180-degree reversal. I mean, we take the whole show to go through all of them, but just think about them. Getting involved in Syria, NATO, yelling at the Fed, the export-import bank, U.S. steel in pipelines, releasing his taxes, China as a currency manipulator. It's a long list. And, you know, all presidents have to evolve on thinking, sometimes change because of different circumstances. But the rate and dramatic level of this guy changing his views dramatically, and these aren't just things he said in a position paper, these are things he ranted about repeatedly and vociferously over a long period of time, means that you can't believe a word that comes out of his mind. I think he's going to get a new title, flip-flopper-in-chief. And this matters. It's a big deal because we were talking about foreign policy on a number of tough places just a few minutes ago. The strength of the United States is being a dependable, consistent partner to countries in the world. And when the President of the United States says one thing one week and completely reverses it again, and he does it repeatedly, again and again and again, people in the world cannot trust him. And just this morning, the former foreign minister of Australia, looking at this, says that Australia, which has been always a United States ally and a strong one in the Pacific, can no longer trust the United States because the president is so inconsistent and unbelievable.
Does this concern you, Kevin, or do you think this is, normal for a new president?
Oh, come on. I mean, really? I'll get to your question, but President Obama promised to close Gitmo. He promised to put 10% of America's energy resources from renewable energy. He promised to get tough with Iran with no incentives. What, gay marriage? He flip-flopped on his views there, promising to secure our borders, government spending reductions. This happens to presidents, but one of the challenges here is that I think many times people on the left forget the points about why the American people elected this man president of the United States. And yes, it was the Electoral College and not the popular vote, but that's a different conversation because of California and New York. But the reality is that the only reason that he's changed his word commentary on NATO is because the NATO nations and the NATO General Secretary decided to ask the other nations to pony up their fair share. Some of these countries were paying less than 10% of what they were supposed to have paid, which was 2% of their GDP. Some of them were paying virtually nothing. And so now that the other nations have decided to pony up their financial fair share, the president said, and I believe it's absolutely true, that this is what he was looking for all along. It wasn't for the abolition of the North American Treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It really was all about how can we keep that part of the world safe, and the U.S. can't bear the entire financial burden. That's really what this was about during the campaign. The president was elected because of his commitment to a secure border and a stronger posture around the world where we are feared by our adversaries rather than coddling them.
You want to react to that, Spencer?
I sure do. It's true that politicians in general and presidents do change positions, moderate them. Sometimes they can't achieve what they want. But it's a question of the degree. And the degree of Trump changing views and just not moderating them, but changing them 180 degrees, not because of changed circumstances. NATO hasn't changed. But because he took positions that he was ill-informed on and turns around on a dime. When you combine the flip-flops he's had with his outright lies about a number of things, everything from Obama wiretapping him to the 5 million people voting illegally, on and on. When you combine the flip-flops with the outright lies, it means that people in the United States and the world in general cannot believe a word that comes out of his mouth. And that's very dangerous. Very dangerous when we can't believe him, because we will be in difficult situations. And you want to believe, regardless of party, the President of the United States, when he addresses the American people on a difficult situation and says he's going to take certain action. But the reality is, with this president, that we can't believe what he says, and we can't be sure that he says one thing this week that he won't say the complete opposite next week.
Let's talk a little bit about Syria. President Trump said in an interview on Tuesday that the U.S. will not get deeply involved in a military conflict in that country. Let's take a listen to that.
We're not going into Syria, but when I see people using horrible, horrible chemical weapons, which they agreed not to use under the Obama administration, but they violated it.
They said they got rid of them.
Hey, look, what I did should have been done by the Obama administration a long time before I did it.
Kevin?
Well, he's right. I mean, President Obama promised that if the Syrians crossed the so-called red line in the sand, that he was going to take action. And I did some research in preparation for the discussion this morning, and on Talk of the Nation a couple of years ago, way back in 2012, actually, one of your commentators, Ted Koppel, talking to Neil Conan in Washington, talked about how, you know, it was very likely that due to the tough stance of the Obama administration with regard to Assad, that he wouldn't be surprised if Assad fell the next week or within 6 months. And that was in July of 2012. In fact, Assad is stronger now than ever. In fact, the Russians are, and Putin are as strongly backing Assad as ever. The Iranians and Hamas are right there with him. Syria is a pretty big country, but it's not huge. It's about the third the size of Turkey, about half the size of Iraq, but about five times the size of Israel and Jordan. And even the Mideast opponents of Israel, enemies of Israel, sworn enemies of Israel, believe, as I do, that without a unified or close to unified opposition against Assad, the danger of him falling in the near term is going to be of greater concern to our allies and the... Can we call it relative stability in the overall Middle East, especially as it relates to our big ally, Israel? I'm not sure it's the best of plans, or it would be the best of plans, to try to take out Assad rather than just to weaken him. The same position I held, if you remember, Joy, back in 1992. coup, 1991, when we went into Iraq, but we stopped short of toppling Saddam Hussein because Syria and Iran were too strong of countries without some opportunity to take a better replacement of Hussein back in 1991.
Spencer, your thoughts on the missile strike and also President Trump saying that President Obama should have done this long ago?
It's pretty ironic for Trump to say that, because back in 2013, when there was the first reports of a gas attack, Obama wanted to go in. He did the right thing and asked for congressional authorization, which is required under the law, and the Republicans refused to give it to him. But you know who led the opposition, the public opposition, to responding to Assad's first gas attack? It was Donald Trump. He and the Republicans he was allied with fought President Obama's desire and request to go into, at least to have a retaliatory action for the gas attack. So Donald Trump, this is another one where he's done a complete 180 flip-flop. But there's a bigger problem here, which is, and I think Kevin touched upon it, we see impulsive actions from Donald Trump as president, but there seems to be no long-term strategy or plan. It just seems to be zigzagging action, often actions that are taken that look good on television, but there's no plan. And Syria is an intractable problem. But we, and launching some Tomahawk missiles one night, it won't do much to change the situation, although it gets good TV. I don't, you know, the gas attack was horrendous, but this fellow Assad, who is another murderous dictator backed by Putin, has been killing his own people, doing terrible bombing runs, including barrel bombs, on the civilian population of areas that are controlled by the rebels. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people, including a great many children, have been killed by these attacks. He's targeted virtually every hospital in the rebel-held areas. And, you know, one day after the Tomahawk missile attack, Syrian and Russian jets were taken off from that airport, again bombing the civilian population. So the gas attack is horrendous. I don't know, get into comparison of which is more hard, gas or carpet bombing. But Assad has been killing his own people for a long time, and now Donald Trump saying that we should go, you know, to get tough on Assad is a complete reversal from what he's been saying for the last 4 years.
Let me bring in Gary and Merrill, and we'll get you to respond, Kevin. Gary and Merrill, go ahead.
Yes, hi. One of your guests had mentioned about what happens after Assad falls. I think we know now that we're going to get Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Egypt. The bombs that are dropping and the missiles, to what end? We've spent $5 trillion over there, and it seems that we're not going to be satisfied till the whole Middle East is destroyed. And as far as killing people, I think there's probably been some attacks that the Americans have made in those countries that have killed some people as well. So,
Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, the guest is right. It's $5 trillion. It seems to have gone down a sewer. But I think we also have a responsibility when dictators are gassing their children to respond. We're the only country, quite evidently, I mean, you didn't hear about the Australians, Spencer Black, so concerned about the Australians. You didn't see them sending in any of their military forces to punish Syria and Assad for what they did to their own children. But I need to add something. In 2012, Nancy Pelosi, you know, Spencer Black is so quick to talk about Donald Trump and his love affair, apparently, supposedly, with the Syrians back in 2012, 2013. Nancy Pelosi actually violated federal law in going to Syria, coddling up to Bashar Assad, and described him as a reforming Western-educated eye doctor. Yes, there are bilateral problems, she said. They might be very real, but they need to be resolved through dialogue and trust. Well, she obviously hasn't changed her tune, because even though it's been 5 years and a lot more people have died and hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Syrians have joined the refugee corps across the globe. Nancy Pelosi certainly wasn't a help in 2012, along with Barack Obama in the White House then.
We need to move into some other stories. This one is somewhat related. In an attempt to discuss the chemical weapons attack in Syria and to condemn Assad and justify the missile strikes, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer invoked the name of Adolf Hitler. Let's take a listen to that.
We didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. You know, you had a, you know, someone as despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to the using chemical weapons.
That drew an instant rebuke from Jewish groups and others who noted that Hitler, of course, used gas chambers to kill millions of Jews during the Holocaust. Spicer later apologized, calling it a blunder and a mistake. So is all forgiven, Spencer?
I don't think it's forgiven. You know, there was, the Holocaust was one of the most horrendous events in modern history. And for Spicer to say this is, unfortunately, it's part of a pattern with this guy, Sean Spicer, who's a total embarrassment and I think a symbol of the incompetence of the Trump administration. He just, every time he gets up, he says ridiculous things and offensive things. This was probably the most offensive. You know, Melissa McCarthy plays him on Saturday Night Live, and she's going to have a tough job trying to make him seem more ridiculous than he makes himself seem. This fellow is a front man for Donald Trump and says incorrect things, offensive things every day as a spokesperson for Donald Trump. I think he should go back to his old job of being the Easter Bunny at the White House egg roll.
Seriously, did he do that?
Yes, that was his job under George Bush, was dressing up as the Easter Bunny for the egg roll. And I think he probably did that well. But as press secretary, he does a terrible job. This is just one of a long line of offensive and outright lies that he says to the press. He has a tough job representing Donald Trump to the press, but this guy should not have this job as the voice of the president to the American people and to the world.
Do you think he should lose his job, Kevin?
No. I mean, every press secretary of every president makes stupid comments and occasionally offensive comments and factually incorrect comments in the rapid, you know, pattern of Q&A, and he said something offensive, he said something incorrect, he said something he shouldn't have said, and he apologized.
We're going to take a short break and then more stories. We'll talk about that United Airlines incident. We will talk about Wisconsin's congressional delegation home on recess, who's holding town halls and who's not and why, and other issues in the news, something on your mind, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Week in Review, talking this week with Kevin Hermaning, chairman of the Republican Party of Marathon County, and Spencer Black, a former Democratic state representative from Madison. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Week in Review guests Spencer Black and Kevin Hermaning, and welcoming your input on the news of the week at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Okay, we'll talk about the not-so-friendly skies now. The lawyer for the passenger who was dragged off a United Airlines plane on Sunday says there will probably be a lawsuit. He says Dr. David Dow had a severe concussion, a broken nose, lost two teeth while being dragged out of his seat by a Chicago aviation security officer. United bumped four passengers on that flight in order to accommodate crew members who needed to get to Louisville to be on a flight. Dow resisted. He would not voluntarily leave and was forcibly removed. The viral video was seen worldwide. It took a while, but finally the CEO of United Airlines apologized and said nobody should be treated that way and said it would not happen again. So how should this not happen again, Spencer?
Well, I think the CEO of United Airlines had one of the great examples of corporate doublespeak, saying that they reaccommodated the passengers on that flight. You know, this is an example of corporate greed. United, by if they weren't didn't have a policy of doing this to passengers or offering for them fair compensation, could have avoided this whole thing. But it's also it should be a cautionary lesson in deregulation. The airlines were deregulated. We have basically almost a monopoly. Just a few airlines have consolidated and merged and control the market. And they have shown a brazen disregard for the public because they don't face market pressures. So we need to, I think we need to re-regulate to some extent the airlines so passengers are treated fairly. This is the most dramatic example, but anybody who's flown, seen higher rates, add-on fees, uncomfortable airlines, unfriendly service, knows that the market for airlines is not working because of the consolidation, and that industry should be re-regulated to protect the consumers.
Your reaction, Kevin, to the incident, and what should happen next?
Well, I am actually in the camp that says that the CEO needs to go. The CEO, Munoz, was tone deaf in his initial two news releases, commentary after the incident originally occurred, and actually blamed the passenger entirely, fully stood behind the actions of everybody involved, both the security personnel as well as the airline personnel, and I don't think that anybody clearly... He hadn't seen the video, I'm guessing. But I think the CEO has to resign. $2 billion of market share has disappeared from the value of United Airlines shareholders. And if the board of directors and the shareholders don't demand his resignation immediately, I think that there's something woefully inadequate about who he has in charge of his entire board. But I think that I disagree that regulation is the answer. Competition is always the answer, and clearly shareholders and consumers alike are already beginning to walk with their feet because the unfriendly skies of United certainly are not getting the job done lately.
Joy, Kevin's right that competition could be the answer, but we don't have much competition. In many markets, you only have one airline because three airlines control almost 80% of the market. So if we had real competition, you could rely on the market. But, you know, years back when AT&T had a monopoly, Lily Tomlin had a skit that where she said, "We're the phone company, we don't care, we don't have to." The same thing is true of the airlines now, because there's so few airlines, and they've colluded to reduce the number of flights and reduce competition. We don't have market forces working. And when that happens, you need the government to step in with safeguards and protections for consumers to make sure that consumers and the average person is protected against corporate greed.
Nonsense. It's public safety during which the government needs to intervene. It's not about corporations whose primary job is to earn a profit for their shareholders and private businesses to make a profit for their owners. That's what the role of government is to provide a level playing field. And, Spencer, there is a level playing field. Already United has had to reduce the number of flights in communities such as Madison and Green Bay and Appleton because Delta is starting to get some of the customer base. So competition does work.
Let me jump in because I forgot about somebody else who might be losing a job that I just want to get a quick reaction from both of you on. Questions are lingering about whether President Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, may be on his way out of the White House. Much has been mentioned about his battle with senior aides aligned with Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Trump also undercut Bannon in two interviews this week, saying that, for example, I like Steve, but, and saying that Trump is his own strategist. So is he or should he be on his way out, Kevin?
Actually, I like Steve Bannon. I think he is a brilliant strategist, but Donald Trump was winning primaries and became the nominee before Steve Bannon showed up in the Trump inner circle. I think they're both brilliant strategists. Donald Trump was able to prevail, and he indirectly has thanked the media many, many times for his victory because they attended every one of his speeches. And the media made President Trump, and now they're seemingly ashamed of their decision to have given him all that attention. But Steve Bannon has been a survivor. I'm not sure that it would be the... In fact, I will tell you that I have spoken with Trump loyalists who told me that if Donald Trump dumps Steve Bannon, that they are virtually giving up on their support for Donald Trump. I have heard that in the last 17 hours, actually.
Spencer?
Steve Bannon never should have been in the White House in the first place. As a publisher of Breitbart News, he was an enabler of white supremacists, racists, anti-Semites. He's exactly the wrong kind of person we need in the highest office in the land. So I'd be happy to see him go, but I think he has no place in an administration of a democratic country.
We have to talk about some other issues, and we have a caller who will bring up the next issue, Ricardo in Racine. Hi, Ricardo.
Good morning. Joy, I've got a real concern. Paul Ryan's my representative, and he's not shown his face in this area for months. We've had town hall meetings in Kenosha and Racine. Hundreds of people have shown up. We picket his office. His poll numbers are down like in the teens in the nation down in Wisconsin. He doesn't stand up to Trump. We're concerned about his take on Social Security and Medicare. We think he doesn't represent us, and he passed very few bills, and we think it's time for a new person. Why is he afraid to come and talk to us?
Let me put a little more context here. Only half of Wisconsin's congressional delegations has confirmed that they will hold town hall meetings during this long April recess. Those who won't include Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican Mike Gallagher, and Democrat Gwen Moore. Republicans Sean Duffy and Senator Ron Johnson have not disclosed their plans. The other five will be holding town halls. We did talk with Congressman Gallagher yesterday, and he said that instead of town halls, he was meeting with as many people and constituents as possible, including holding one-on-one meetings. So, Kevin, is Speaker Ryan and others afraid to hold a town hall meeting?
I think the members of Congress are sick and tired of having the town hall meetings become an opportunity for people to disrupt and deny people who want an opportunity to express legitimate concerns and legitimate views in a civil manner. That's my view. I'm a strong advocate of protest and opposition, have participated in many over my last 35 years, and I would just simply say that I think it's a valuable opportunity to hear from voters, but when they are disruptive and become violent and people who happen to support the Congress member or the President of the United States get spat upon and their signs taken away and their automobiles damaged, I think it's perfectly fine that they take a pause on this. People
Spencer.
Need to take a chill pill.
Spencer, do you need to take a chill pill?
I hope not. There's been very little violent activity at these town halls. I haven't seen that.
Goodness,
but what we have seen is citizens speaking up and exercising their rights in a democracy. I think these Republicans who are not having town hall meetings are chicken to face their constituents. There's a reason why Paul Ryan has gotten the title the Cowardly Ryan, because he's unwilling to come back to his district and talk and face the music for what he's been doing. You know, Paul Ryan, much like some of the monopoly corporations, feels like he doesn't have to answer to his constituents because his district has been so gerrymandered that he doesn't face serious competition. If he had his old first congressional district before the gerrymandering, chances are he wouldn't still be in Congress. So this points to a problem, much like we have, you know, consolidation and monopolies with corporations, is that so many of these congressional districts have been gerrymandered to eliminate real competition that many of the people in Congress feel they don't have to listen to their constituents or face them at town hall meetings because their districts, they're invincible because of the gerrymandering of their districts.
Let's talk about former Democratic Wisconsin Attorney General and past Weekend Reviewer Peg Lautenschlager resigned from the State Ethics Commission last Friday. She said that there were a lot of factors at play. A couple of days later, her son, former federal prosecutor and Madison attorney Josh Call, announced he would challenge Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel in next year's election. He's the first Democrat to declare a run for attorney general. Spencer, what do you think?
Well, I think it's probably became obvious. I was a little perplexed when Peg Lautenschlager resigned and didn't give a reason or didn't enunciate the reasons. But when her son announced that he was running a few days later, it became pretty clear why she had to step down. The Ethics Commission oversees not just governmental ethics, but also the campaign finance of candidates running for state office. And she obviously couldn't be in a position of chairing the commission that oversaw campaign finance when her son was running for a state office.
Yeah. Do you think that Brad Schimmel, Spencer, is vulnerable to a Democratic challenge?
Oh, I think he's very vulnerable. He has a whole list of, I think, inappropriate actions and not doing a good job as Attorney General. I think Peg's son, who announced, is probably just the first of several Democrats who will come forward to challenge him in the next election.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
Well, I think it's not a surprise that the person who's headed up the Ethics Commission feels that she should relinquish her position if her son is running for any partisan office, quite honestly. I also would add that I can never quite understand how any partisan leader, in this case Governor Walker, in the case of the White House, President Trump, how and why they would put in charge of such an important, responsible position somebody who is diametrically opposed to their political worldview. You know, I know she was Attorney General, but why is she the head of the Ethics Commission, which was created since Governor Walker's been governor? I don't get it.
I think they had a number of people from different parties on that, if I'm not mistaken. But
they do. Yeah. But why would the chairperson be of the same of the opposite party? That's all I'm saying. What doesn't make sense? It's no different than President Trump's chief economic advisor. Why would he have Gary Cohn, a lifelong Democrat, in charge of his economic viewpoints? Makes no sense to a partisan such as myself.
We have just a minute left tomorrow. Traditionally, tax day, April 15th, a bunch of protesters are planning on marching on Washington, D.C. to call on President Trump to release his personal tax returns. Other protests in other cities across the country, including downtown Milwaukee. Really quickly, because almost out of time, Spencer, should President Trump release his tax returns?
No surprise here. Absolutely. The American public has a right to see why he's been dodging traffic taxes and what connections he has with mm-hmm. Russia and financially.
Kevin?
I don't really care if he releases them. A number of them were illegally released a couple of months ago from, 2005, 2006, mm-hmm. and clearly he's not been dodging tax payments because he paid something like $300 million that year.
Thanks to both of you for being with us. Coming up, by the way, on our state capitol report, we will talk about a new bills to address homelessness in Wisconsin. We will hear from Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinecke, who authored one of the bills, and Democratic State Representative Lisa Subek, who is concerned about some of these bills. That's the state capitol report on Monday from 7 to 8. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.